Okay, fine. So the last few times we spent on the question of why Mishnah and then why Gemara, but more specifically, we now need to move to the question of why Bavli, and then we'll deal with Ellie's question, which is, how does any of this affect the way we think about later codes and later post-given things like that? Okay? So, hopefully we can get both of these questions done today, I hope. So, let's talk about the reason why Imkvar, we've accepted the notion that you should be bound by the Mishnah and then later the Gemara, why the Bavli over the Yerushalmi? So before you even look at the sources, if I ask you, okay, let's assume you've bought this, right? Bavli over Yerushalmi. That's right, that you've accepted the notion of binding Gemara. Why, logically, would there be any reason to prefer one over the other? Yeah, Ellie.
Okay, so the contract is tied into the question of the Mishnah Torah, we get it later.
Yeah.
When you're describing the Mishnah Torah, it said that the Mishnah Torah was accepted by all of Israel.
Okay, good.
The question is, it would be
accepted. Very good, okay. So, very good. So Ellie says, it's very simple. Right, Ellie said it very simple. Ellie could predict it. Ellie said, look, there's a whole strain of thought, that said the reason that the Mishnah is binding, and the reason the Gemara is binding is because we accepted it. And if we accepted it, so then you have a very easy out, which is, well, we did that to the Bavli, we didn't do it to the Yerushalmi. And whether you think that formally, like there was a vote for Bavli and there wasn't for Yerushalmi, or using informally, it's about acceptance. So just say that, well, we did that to Bavli and we didn't do that to Yerushalmi. Who says that?
No.
The Beit Yishai. The Beit Yishai. Now, who is the Beit Yishai? Beit Yishai is 20th century. Fisher, and his drasha, Beit Yishai, he says exactly that, and this is source 12. Yeah, 12. HaTalmud HaYerushalmi Ho'il Ve'eino Mitukan Etzleinu Kol Tzarko. He says, look, the Yerushalmi is not edited so much. It's not so perfected textually, which, if you ever learn Yerushalmi, it is a nightmare and a half. Okay, I'll give you an example. Yesterday I was learning with my Chavrusa. I have a Shabbos Yerushalmi Chavrusa. So we had a passage in Yerushalmi where the original version, the text we have has one pasuk as the basis for the drasha. The version in the Rosh and the Rush have that same girsa. The Pnei Moshe, Rosh Cirilio, and the Gra change the girsa based on Svara, which then leads them to conclude that it's in contradiction to the Bavli, which it might not be because the Bavli is quoting a different pasuk. And then later on, it quotes a different pasuk, and there are no less than just on the page of the Yerushalmi six girsa possibilities into what pasuk is quoting, and if there is a pasuk quoting, is it a smachta, a hekesh, a mamatzinu, or a gzeir shaveh, and does that matter, and what part? That was one little passage, okay? It's just terrible. And do you know how many manuscripts we have to look at it? Basically one, right? This is all, it's terrible.
Is that like a sport thing like that? Some things have gotten
lost. Let's read the Beit Yishai, and he says, the Rabu Bo Hashibushim. He said, why are there so many mistakes? Lemiyud Halom Bimbo. Because nobody learns it. Or not many people learn it. That's true. It's a shame. As you know, I like Yerushalmi. I really have to set up a time for a Siyum. We have to do that. Right, Ginsburg wants me to do it here. So
I have to.
Oh, 1 second. So he says, "Ve'ein omdim bo alarake echad bador." There's only one in a generation who understand it. Okay. I don't think that's true anymore. There must be like 10. But no. Now that art school has Yerushalmi, there must be like 10, right? The art school is wonderful in Yerushalmi. I endorse it fully. Below hayu bidehari shonim bekviot mipnei ha'aniyot. And he said, the Rishonim just didn't really learn it because, whatever, they didn't. A bunch of reasons. They were poor, they didn't have the books, they didn't have the manuscript, they didn't bother, who knows. And we accepted all our customs come from Babel, not Israel. And therefore, you see, they didn't accept the Babli it as much as they accepted the Babli. So what does Shlomo Fisher basically say? Yeah, thank you. That, if you had to summarize Shlomo Fisher, the answer is it happened. Why did it happen? Because nobody learned it. Because nobody learned it, no one bothered editing it. Because no one edited it, it got harder to learn, so no one bothered learning it. Because no one learned it, they didn't edit it. Because they didn't edit it, they didn't bother learning it. By the end of this process, nobody bothered learning your Shlomo, so no one followed it, and if we don't follow it, then you don't follow it. Right? Meaning, if you think it's about non-formal acceptance, the answer is, I don't know exactly why it happened, but it was a self-perpetuating, right? It was a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? People didn't read it because they didn't want to, and because they didn't want to, they didn't edit it, and it made it impossible to read, and therefore no one else read it, and if no one read it, so no one followed it, and that was it. And yes, the answer is, when you read the Yerushalmi, look, the first, when I first started learning Yerushalmi, it was hard. Admittedly, by the end of it, it was easier, but it's still hard, right? Meaning, having, I can now say this, having learned all of Yerushalmi minus Stephen Blatt, okay, which is what I'm getting through with my cover stuff. It doesn't get that, it gets a little bit easier, but no, it never really gets easy. Because like, you know, no one learned it, so it's a mess. It's a mess. No, it's like unedited. Okay, examples. Things that happen in the Yerushalmi that don't happen in the Babli, besides for terrible Gersod. Sometimes, you know how in the Babli, in order to understand things, sometimes there's a parallel sugya. So what does the Babli do? It quotes the parallel sugya so that you can understand it. You know what the Yerushalmi does? Nothing. It tells you Ayin Sham, and then at some point, the person copying the manuscript left out the reference, and therefore you read the Yerushalmi, and until you look at the version, you don't realize there are pages missing that are necessary to understand what's going on. That happens sometimes. Then there's these wonderful cases where there are floating letters in the Yerushalmi. Why are there floating letters? Oh, why are there floating letters in the Yerushalmi? Because some copyist couldn't read what it was, so instead of saying, I don't know what it is here, he wrote down whatever letters he could make out. So there's just random things floating. The Yerushalmi is very hard to read, okay? It's very hard to read. It gets very confusing. And that's if you get past the fact that it's written in a different dialect of Aramaic, and that Yerushalmi, there are certain things in the Babli that you take for granted, even though I know that sometimes you find the Babli hard to read, it has helpful cues. Things like the word Omar, or things like that, right? What? Doesn't matter. Things that say he said. That's not in the Yerushalmi. In the Yerushalmi, often when someone starts talking, it just says their name, and then it just starts saying things without an amar or a mativ or any of those words that say he said, he asked, he answered. Those aren't in the Yerushalmi usually. Then there's the fact that like certain letters just don't appear in the Yerushalmi, like the letter Aleph. Often the letter Aleph just falls out. So like Rabbi Abba in the Babli is Rabbi Ba in the Yerushalmi, right? Now, this was confusing. Even to Jacob Neusner, who translated the whole Yerushalmi, not a good translation, part of that was he read through, somehow translated the whole Yerushalmi, never picked up on the fact that the guy's name was Rabbi Ba, and instead every time Rabbi Ba comes up, he translates it as Rabbi King. Rebbe didn't go anywhere. Rebbe Ba said something. Those aren't the same thing, right? It's very hard to read your Shalom if you're not used to it. It never means Rebbe came. It always means Rebbe Ba said. Always. Yeah. But basically, more or less, what's the Beit Yishai's answer? Why do we accept the Yerushalmi over the Babli of the Yerushalmi?
Because we're actually going to say the Babli.
Because we did, because it's easy to understand, whatever, who cares? We did, and it was, once we did, so we learned it, and once we learned it, it was easy to read, well.
Yeah,
but he doesn't even say that. He basically says what Ezra said, no take back these. Yes, is we did, and now deal with it. Yes, that was the answer. That is the very deeply conceptual answer of the Beit Yishai, which is no take back these. Thank you, Ezra. Okay, good. Now, that's possibility one. Possibility two is the rift. Yes? Very good. Rami, what does the rift say?
The rift says, that if you want to,
two words. That was three words, but sure. In Hebrew, it's halacha kibatrai. There's a rule in Sakh, and I'm not going to now give you a shiur on this rule, but I can send you a link to when I gave it last year. There's a rule in Sakh, which I know is counterintuitive to everything you've ever learned, called halacha kibatrai. The halacha always follows the leader people. That's it. Halacha kibatrai. Now, the basic, there is a lot of explanations, but the simplest logic that is brought to halacha kibatrai is... Yes, exactly, which is, yes, the later authorities were aware of what was said before them, and therefore when they paskin with broader perspective, or... So, if you want the easy answer is the, as I keep mentioning, is the dwarfs on the shoulders of giants, mashal, which is quoted in the name of everybody. It apparently was originally in the name of some St. Charles of somewhere in France or something. But it's quoted in all types. It's quoted by all types of people. In Jewish sources, it's quoted by the Shvil Heleket, who in turn is quoting it from the Tosfos Reid, who is in turn quoting it from some chacham min ha'amin. Some chacham. It's somebody. Someone said it at some point. Which is basically, even if you think as persons, individuals, the Rishonim were greater than us, right? We have an easier time because we are midgets on the shoulders of giants, and therefore we see farther anyways, right? So as individuals, they may have been greater, but we still have a broader perspective, and therefore we pass them like us. Now, obviously, there are limits, because does that mean that just because I'm later, now everyone has to pass them like me, and you guys are younger than me, so everyone has to pass them like you? No, obviously, there are limits to this rule, and I don't want to get into the rule too much, but the Rif's basic rule is, look, the Bavli came about 100 years after the Yerushalmi, and therefore it was aware of the traditions in Eretz Yisrael. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, I don't know, right? But the answer is, it was later. So, that's why we said Bavli Yerushalmi. Halacha kibatrai. Yes, Ellie. No, they were later. That's it. Halacha kibatrai.
Therefore,
that's it. Right? Therefore, they are. Meaning, right, the Rif just says, right, he says, Al Gemara Dilam Samchin Debatru, the Inu have a, right, meaning he brings this argument, the Inu have a Bikia, the Gemara Dilam Arabah, Tzemi Nun. Right? So his argument is a little bit fancier than that, which is, they knew the Talmud Yerushalmi, or the traditions recorded in it, and they knew it better than us. If they didn't know that you shouldn't pass on the Yerushalmi, they wouldn't have said it. Meaning, they knew the Yerushalmi, and they had broader perspective, and therefore, whatever decisions they made incorporated the Yerushalmi. And if they chose not to paskin like the Chachamei Eretz Yisrael, they were doing that for a reason. Okay? So reason two is, that's right. Okay, good. Reason three. And this is one of the earliest sources that we have, from Pirkei Ben Bavoi. So Pirkei Ben Bavoi is, as I mentioned, 8th, 9th century. This is Gaonic Babylonian Apologetica. Okay? Apologetic. Okay? That's who this is. Okay, he's an apologist for Babel. That's what he does for a living. Okay? So, what does Pirkei Ben Bavoi say? Now, I said, Simcha Gross, who wrote this was his dissertation. Simcha and I were chavrusas for a bit in Gush. We were also together in high school. He's a year older than me in Rambam. So, he has a large section in his dissertation devoted called Empires and Neighbors, Babylonian Jewish Identity in Local and Imperial Context, to Pirkei Ben Bavoi. So what does Pirkei Ben Bavoi say? So here's his summary. Pirkei has a fairly straightforward series of arguments. One, Palestinian Judaism under Rome and Greece, and even earlier with the destruction of the First Temple, experienced persecution, whereas Babylonian Judaism did not. Two, this persecution interrupted the transmission of Oral Torah in Palestine, whereas in Babylonia the transmission continued uninterrupted. Three, as a result, Babylonian Torah is authentic and reliable, while Palestinian Torah is not. Right? So the argument is, People write better when they don't have a gun to their head. And Babylonians didn't, and Israelis did. Don't ask me, ask Pirkei Avot and Bavli. I'm just telling you what he said. Yes, is this problematic yet? Is it true that the Jews in Eretz Israel had a worse time than the Jews in Babel? Yes, probably yes.
Is it not a whole galus named after Babel?
Correct, but Babel, but it was a pretty comfortable galus. It was pretty comfortable for a while. That's the point, is that the galus in Babel at that time was pretty comfortable as opposed to the situation in Israel, which was not so comfortable. And therefore, people learn better when they have peace of mind. And the people in Babel did, the people in Eretz Israel did not. And this is what he writes, right? You mean Yerushalmi?
No,
because things were... Because things were in grade, but they were better than they were in Eretz Israel. I don't know. Right? This is what he writes, right? So he says, if you want... So we look at it. He says, Shamani Shibawat Lachem Zamidim Yeshiva. Right, heard that people came from you, Mehen Shayu Kodem Be'eretz Yisrael, V'lamdu Minag Eretz Yisrael V'nagu, Minagei Ashmas, V'nagu Ben Ben Eretz Yisrael. I heard that there were people who keep the Minagim Eretz Yisrael. Right, now, he says, what is, how does he characterize the Minagim Eretz Yisrael? Minagei Shmad. What is Shmad?
Persecution.
The Minagim they had under persecution. And he writes, Ubi Babel Lo Paska Torah Mi Yisrael. In Babel, there never stopped being Torah. So what did he say? In Eretz Israel, there was Rome, and then there was, and they spat them out, and there was the Persians, and then there was whatever. And in Babel, they have two yeshivot, which were always functioning. It was great, right? The Halig yeshivas of Lakewood and Mir, you know, I mean, Surin, Kumpadisa, whatever. You know, whatever. Six dozen, you know, six of one, half dozen the other. It's all the same, right? Fine. And then he says, God promised that the Torah would never be forgotten. And how did God fulfill his promise? God established the two yeshivas of Surim Pumbedika in Babel, where Shahogan Bitarium and Valaila, they learned Torah day and night, and become Shefam Mishana Badar Ve'elo, become a governor of the Milcham to Shel Torah, twice a year they get together, and they learn Torah, Achim Amidin Dabar Al-Borya, until they establish the Torah of Halach Al-Mitam Mavin, Raya Minakram Minam Mishra Minat Talmud, Kadesh Lekash Lu Torah, Yisrael B'divrei Torah, they learn Tanakh and Mishnah and Gemara, and to make sure that no one makes mistakes. And there was always peace, and they learned it. They learned calmly, and there was never persecution. We know already in the Torah, in Navi, it says that 11 years, or 12 years, as he said, but whatever, in the 12 years, 11 years, whatever, before Korban HaBayit, what happened? What does Tanakh itself say? No, the best and the brightest were kicked out of Eretz Israel 11 years before Korban HaBayit and sent to Babel. Who says this? Yechezkel. Right? Yechezkel tells them that the future of Israel will be with you who went into Galut. Right, that's what Yechezkel says. He's the Navi to the Galut. And he says, you are the future. Right, you are the future. You are in Babel. So Pirkei Avot B'Babel takes this very seriously, and he says, yeah, the best and the brightest, it's also in Malachim, obviously, right, but it's more expanded in Yechezkel, right, he says, in Malachim it tells you that the best and the brightest were exiled from Eretz Yisrael and sent to Babel. And if the best and the brightest were sent to Babel, what does that tell you? Yeah, very good. That all the Talmid Chacham were there, and therefore, right, so if you go to the summary, skip to Simcha's summary, he says, in Pirkei's schema, there is never, therefore never a moment of rupture in the Babylonian tradition. Torah escapes Palestine before the destruction of the first temple and travels untainted to Babylonia. Babylonia's preservation of the Oral Torah will, with divine guidance, continue until the end of days. Pirkei's narrative essentially takes Halacha Moshe Mitzrayim to mean, quite literally, an unbroken chain of tradition dating back to Sinai. So, what does Pirkei basically say? Which model does this overlap with in any way, shape, or form? Chazanish. Right? Chazanish. Yeah. Right? Meaning the Chazanish. Why does the Chazanish say we follow the Mishnah?
Because
they were closer to the tradition, so they know the truth. Why do we follow the Gemara according to him? Because they were closer to the tradition of the Jews. Pirkei ben Bavel basically says, yes, but who were the heirs to said tradition? Bavel. And not Eretz Israel, because Bavel has an untainted, unpersecuted tradition that goes back to Sinai, and Eretz Israel, in Eretz Israel, they're persecuted, and therefore their tradition was broken.
But who's to say that someone greater didn't come up in Eretz Israel, learn by himself, and...
You're asking me to justify the position of an 8th, 9th century polemicist. I'm not going to say he's right, I'm just telling you what he said, right? Okay, so basically we have three views. The Beit Yishai, which is, I don't know, we did. What do you want from my life? We did. Get over it. What if we don't want to? The answer is, really? Who reads Yerushalmi? Don't tell me that we could. If you want to accept Yerushalmi over Bavli, find a group of people willing to read it. Good luck. Right? We did, we continue to, we did, get over it. The rift, the answer is, it is later. And therefore, they were aware of the traditions of Israel, and they didn't accept them. Deal. Pirkei ben Bavli is, they have the truth, and Eretz Israel did not. Because Bavel has an untainted tradition back to Sinai, because they didn't have persecution, and Eretz Israel did not, and therefore, accept Bavli, don't accept Yerushalmi. What do you want from my life? Okay? Very good. Now, there is obviously the unstated possibility, which is... Thank you, Yaakov. Thank you. Which was, who said? Right? Meaning... The assumption of these three answers are that we did accept the Bavli or the Yerushalmi. However, if you had lived 1,000 years ago, you know, even post-Talmud, the answer might be, says who? And if you know anything about Jewish history, you discover that Rav Sajigon, the answer in many ways might be Rav Sajigon. Because Rav Sajigon, one of the things that he spent much of his life doing was fighting with the people in Eretz Israel who thought that they were not dependent on Bavel, and they had a different calendar, and the holidays fell on different days than it did in Bavel. And Rav Sajigon spent a good part of his life fighting them and saying, no, you can't do that. We're in charge, and eventually basically won. But the simplest answer might be some version of the Beit Yishai, which is we accepted the Bavli, but unlike the Beit Yishai, who presumably assumes that happened immediately after the Bavli was written, we know that there were plenty of people who didn't accept this for a good several hundred years. Eventually it's true, right? But it took quite a while for that to happen, because for a long time, people just, you know, didn't necessarily do this. There are even Svarim in the Gaonic times, which are literally called Halachot Bein Bavel Eretz Israel, right? Which are records of divergent traditions that emerged in Bavel and Eretz Israel. And there are plenty of scholars, right? Most prominently Israel Tashma and Avram Grossman, who point out that many of the traditions in Ashkenaz, amongst the Balei Tosfot, don't easily accord with the Bavli and seem to be much more Eretz Israel influenced. So the truth is that this line is not historically as clear-cut as programmatic statements might tell you. Chaim Soloveitchik has pushed back on this and argued that it's not true, and said maybe it's true in liturgy, but it's not really true in halacha. And then to explain some of these divergences, he has proposed that maybe there was a third yeshiva in Bavel, and has written an entire series, a whole theory that really the reason Eretz Yisrael looks a little bit different is they were following Bavel, but a tradition in Bavel that is not necessarily reflected in Surin Pupadita. But the last possibility is, of course, you know, maybe to some extent this is overstated. Oh, no. There is zero evidence for this. It's all by negation. Basically because there's a lot of unexplained evidence that in Ashkenaz, which is weird, like there's a bunch of Masechtot in the Bavli that seem to use a different dialect of Aramaic and deal with topics that no one seems to have bothered learning in most of Bavel, and the Balei Tosfot learn these Masechtot and have Pedrushim these Masechtot, but the Sephardi Rishonim don't. So he basically compiles a lot of interesting things, plus all these divergent Minhagim in Bavel, in Ashkenaz, and basically puts them all together and says, aha, to explain all of this, there is a different yeshiva in Bavel who were interested in different topics and spoke a slightly different dialect, and the Ashkenazim are somehow the heirs to this tradition, and... I don't know. Look, it's one of the more ambitious theories that he's advanced. It doesn't have direct evidence. It's basically his culmination of many years of, here's all the things that are weird about Ashkenaz. Let's try to put it together and come up with a theory. I am definitely not qualified to argue with him. He is one of the smartest and most terrifying human beings that you will ever encounter, if you ever encounter him. He's very, very, very smart. He's Rabbi Soloveitchik's son, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik. I'm not qualified to weigh in on this. I have no interest in challenging him. It's scary. The way he gives class is scary. He gave a chabura when I was in YU to like a small group of Talmidim Rosenzweig share, and like he's famous for, if people aren't prepared enough, he just kicks them all out of class. And even if he kicks everybody out of class, he will continue teaching till the end of the class, even though there's nobody in the room, no recorder, and then you are responsible for whatever you missed, because, you should have been there. And if someone asks a question he can't answer, he decides that he's not prepared and kicks himself out of class. Right, he's very, very demanding. Sure. I mean, it is fair. What? Yeah, he's very, very demanding. He's very, very precise. He's very, very smart, the stories about him are legendary because of how demanding. What? I mean, I remember when he used to do this in YU. He's known for being very scary. One of the Rambam and Gush told me that one semester he took over for his father. His father was sick. So he gave shir on bracha, I think it was sixth perek. And there's a lot of, sixth perek is Ketzav Mevarchin. It's a lot of examples of what do you make brachot on? And he would make everyone read the German and French dictionaries to try to figure out what every little plant and food is referencing Mara. And at some point yelled at them because he asked what a certain word was in Old French. And they told him what it was, and he yelled at them because they were irresponsible, because clearly they had looked it up in a modern French dictionary and gave him the modern translation rather than the medieval French dictionary when it meant something different, and they didn't have the heart to tell him that it was Rav Lichtenstein who had told them that's what it meant, because Rav Lichtenstein is French. Rav Lichtenstein was born in France and had told him what he thought it meant because he was French, right? But, hadn't looked up the medieval French. It was the way that I dropped when I was an undergraduate, I took a few graduate courses. You can take a few graduate courses undergraduate, not with him. But I gave up on a certain class because I just didn't have time with a full undergraduate thing when the first week he you know, one of the assignments was like 500 pages in German. Like, I really don't have time to read German, to learn German. Turned out it was an English article in a German journal, but how was I supposed to know that? I don't even know where to find German journals, you know, and I wasn't in graduate school, you know, I was an undergraduate. Yeah, that's the type of thing I can't, you know. Yes. Though I've heard from all female students that he's nicer to females, you know. He's just, you know. He was just much nicer with them. What? I don't know. This is what all females who were in his class said. He was just nicer to them.
Like how much nicer?
Like, if he saw that they were tired, he would tell them to take a nap in class, right? Rather than, you know, guys who he's like, you know.
Oh,
what?
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what to tell you. Okay? Fine. But, what?
Weren't the requirements of the 12 not being yourself, you can talk to each other? Like, you see them sometimes?
Sometimes, yes. Clearly, I mean, yes.
So they do have each other's opinion.
I mean, the Bavli is 100 years later than the Yerushalmi, so not everything. Meaning, there are, right, remember, the Bavli is many layered, right? There are many generations there. So the earlier ones, there might have been conversations, but obviously the last 100 years, the Yerushalmi had already been published, as it were. So they're not aware of it. That's the Rizk argument, right? That the Bavli, being 100 years later, simply is aware of everything in Eretz Yisrael, which Eretz Yisrael cannot be aware of everything in Bavel because the Bavli incorporates another 100 years of traditions.
Right, so why is that the thing where all the Greeks of Israel were sent to Bavel?
I don't know. That's what he said. I mean, his argument is all the way back in time, not now. He's saying since Korban Abayit. Okay, fine. So those are a few theories on why, in Kvar, you accept the Bavli, the Talmud, why you accept specifically the Bavli rather than the Yerushalmi. Okay, fine. Let's stop that there. And now let's move to the question that Ellie raised, which is, where's Rami, by the way? Okay, he's going to miss. Just before I start something new, I just want to make, you know, I never like starting a next subtopic if he's... Rami! Yeah, I figured. Okay, well, we're going to have to start anyways. I don't want to keep you all waiting. Fine. So, Ellie asked the right question. Ellie, what was your question? Remind everyone how we got to where we are now. Right, meaning Ellie had asked specifically Shulchan Aruch, but really, if I want to get to the heart of what Ellie's asking, you didn't mean Shulchan Aruch per se. You meant... You meant, right, meaning how does the way we think about the acceptance of Mishnah and Gemara and Bavli and whatever, how does that affect the way we think about later codes, later authorities, okay? And I think, and this is, again, this is for me, this is quite recent, but I think that the clearest way to see this is in the question over the Rambam. So, Moshe Halbertal is a professor half the time at Hebrew U and half the time at Harvard. One semester a year he teaches at Harvard, one semester a year he teaches at Hebrew U, otherwise he lives in Israel. Remember, I know this sounds like a lot, but remember, academic semester is like 14 weeks, right? So to say that he's half, you know, one semester at Harvard, right, that means you spend 14 weeks at Harvard and maybe, you know, you come back a little bit during mid-semester break, right? College is very short. You forget this, but the year is very short in college. Semesters are 14.
Semester break for 14 weeks.
Yeah, think about it, right? You have, like, Thanksgiving in the fall, and you have, like, spring break in the middle of... Right, and this is in places where you have semesters. If you're like in Chicago, they have quarters, right, or whatever, right, like four mini semesters or something, quarter, whatever they call it, quarter semesters. I don't know. What? That's what they do. I don't know. I don't know. I had a cousin in Chicago. I don't know. What? University of Chicago? Yes, but it's also one of the most rigorous places in the country. So, go figure. Okay. What? Anyway, so Halbertal in his book, which I know it's very hard to remember the name, but it's called Maimonides. That's the name of the book.
Could he have come up with something more
I think it's called Maimonides Life and Works, okay? Fine, Life and Thought, something like that. Anyways, so Halbertal has a chapter on the Mishnah Torah, and he notes that there seems to be a tension in the Rambam. What did the Rambam want out of life when he wrote the Mishnah Torah? So he notes that there are, if you read it straight, there are two different implications you might get out of the Rambam. Okay? So let's read the Rambam in his Akdama and Mishnah Torah. Right? So the Rambam in his Akdama and Mishnah Torah, he's telling you what exactly this code is. What does he tell you? So he tells you, Uvizmana zet takut tarot yeterot v'dachaka sha'ayrako. In this time, in this age, there are many afflictions. The wise have lost their wisdom. The insight of the wise has been hidden. Now, why does he tell you that? What is he about to set up? Why is it important that he's telling you things are bad? Oh, very good, Ellie. Because he said he recognized at his own moment he's reliving Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, right? Meaning he is now placing himself in the shoes of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who was forced because of troubles and travails that faced the Jewish people and the diminishing of wisdom in the world to write the Mishnah. And the Rambam sees in his own times the same thing, because the Rambam's life was, you know, hard. Well, I'm not mocking him. I'm just saying. He's placing himself in Rebbe's shoes. That's basically what happened. The Rambam is born in circa 1140. He dies circa 1204, 1205. Right? Give or take. Well, let's see. The Rambam was born where? Yes, and then how did he end up in Egypt? Because he was kicked out of the Almohad. Yes, it was bad. What? He started in Europe. Spain is Europe.
Right.
He's in Cordoba, and then he, you know, gets chased out and ends up in Egypt, right? And then he ends up working for the Sultan. Yes, which Sultan? Yes. Yes, of course. The most famous of all terrible sultans. Yes. If you ever played Age of Empires, you know, which when I was a kid was still a CD that you put in your computer. I get it's not anymore. But it, you know, yes, it's a great game. It's great. What? Yeah. I honestly, I liked it so much as a kid. I'm like, I've debated doing it, but I just can't get into that. I really have no time for computer gaming. What? Unbelievable. But it was good. Yeah, I learned so much history. And it was a fun game. Anyway, there was like the historical version, which was Age of Empires, and then there was the non-historical version, which was Roller Coaster Tycoon, which were basically the same game, except you were either building empires or building theme parks. Yeah, they were awesome. Yeah, they were awesome. Yeah, they were awesome. They were great. I mean, you know, it was, look, those I understand how those became successful, why we all liked the Oregon Trail, which was like the lowest tech game and you consistently died of dysentery, I don't know, right? You know the Oregon Trail? Have you ever played it? It was hysterical. It was like this old game where like, you went on the Oregon Trail, but like randomly you would lose because you would get dysentery or typhoid fever or like it was crazy. You died of starvation or you were hit by a tornado. It was crazy. And it was like the worst graphics ever. Oh my God. It was great. It was so much fun. I loved it. I loved it. It was amazing. Anyways, But yeah, the Rambam is setting himself up basically as Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. And what does he say? Lefichach otana perushin v'atshuva v'alachot shechibru gaonim. And therefore, all those commentaries and responses that were written by the gaonim. V'ra'u shehim dvarim v'arim. It used to be clear. Now they are hard to understand. V'ein mevin inanem karoyam atmim v'nispar. There are only a few people who understand them. V'ein zarach lomar atamar atzmon. Forget the Gemara. Right? Like, how many people know to read Gemara? Habavli, Verushalmi, Sifras, Sifrei, Yato, Sefto, and by that he means all of Chazal, right? Shehin Tzvichin Dad Rechava Veneved Chachama Uzman Aruch. You need a lot of time, and you need to be very smart, and not sleep, and all those things, right? Then you'll understand it. This is why I try so hard to, like, cover all of Chazal. This is, like, my life goal, right? Slowly but surely. Now I'm on Sifra. Did you recall me? Now I'm trying Sifra. I cannot promise by the end I will understand all that, but I'm doing my best. Right? He says, and then by the end of all that, you'll understand the Torah. But since it is so hard, he says, therefore I girded my loins. I, Moses, the son of Maimon, the Sardi. And I've relied on the Lord, the Rock of Ages. And I've read every book. And I put it all together. I've taken all of Torah and made it clear. Now, to be fair, he did. Okay? But without any cynicism, he literally did that. It's crazy. He just did. I mean, it's insane. It's an insane feat. Kulan concise and clear. Atzei Torah Shabbat Kulas Darabeth Vikol. So that all of Torah Shabbat is clear in the mouth of anyone who wants. Below Kushiv, low Perig, no questions, no answers, no Shach Levataria, low Zemr Bechov, Zemr Ko. None. He says this, he says that, none of that. Elad Barim Burim Krovim Nechonim. Simple, straightforward. It really is. All 982 chapters. But it is. It is. It's unbelievably clear. It really is. Alpi Mishpat, I mean, and like he really did spend a lot of time. Like it is one of those amazing things when you actually look at the original, the handwritten copy of the Rambam, you realize he like crosses out, reorganizes all the time. It's amazing. It's amazing, amazing, amazing. I encourage you, if you ever get a chance to go and actually look at the Rambam's own handwritten manuscripts, you discover that, what?
Where is that?
Right now, I don't know. I've seen the exhibit multiple times. I saw it when it was on loan in New York. I saw it when it was on loan here. Most of it is kept, I think, in Oxford, but I saw it when it was on loan at the Jewish Museum on the Upper East Side, and I saw it when it was on loan at the Israel Museum. And I went with friends with a Rambam in hand, and you actually see where he crosses off, reorganizes, and you can look at your Mishneh Torah and see how it has been reorganized and how every word is crossed. Like, he really did it. It's not like, you know... You also can see in the Perush HaMishnayot. It's amazing. Absolutely incredible. And he said, I've basically taken everything since Rabbeinu HaKadosh until now. Until every mitzvah and everything is clear to every person. So no one will ever need any book except for the Rambam. It collects all the Shabbat Beh, imatakanot, minagot, agzerot, the customs, the minhag, everything. He's pretty clear. Everything from Moses until the Gemara, until Ukamoshi Parashat Gonim, plus all the Gonic works. And therefore I call this the Mishnah Torah, Adam Torah, because all you need is first Tanakh. Your goal in life should be two things. Read Tanakh and read this, and then you are done. Once you do that, you will know all of Torah Shebaal Peh. The Eino Sarich, the Krot Sefer Acher Benehem, without the need to read any other books. That was the Rambam's goal. That the only things you would need in all of life are Tanakh and the Rambam. Zehu, Zeh. That's it. What? Yes, I wouldn't need that big bookshelf I have in my house. I would need a one volume Tanakh and a one volume Mishneh Torah, and then I can use the rest of my house for other things. Right? No other book. That's it. I don't need a bookshelf. I could put it in my knapsack and keep all I ever needed in a knapsack. What? Mapita. Boring? No. It's all knowledge at my fingertips in 2 books. You're right. That's all I need. I need my phone. That's it. All I need is my smartphone, and that is all you need.
Oh,
Zehu, yeah?
I mean, so I guess...
is the air conditioning not on? It's so hot in here. What? Yes, I know. It's like 100 degrees today. Oh my god, where's the... I'm like dehydrated in here. Well, okay. Now, here's the question. You can't find it? Where is it? We really have to turn this on and blast it. It's miserably hot. I don't know. Okay. So anyways, right, here's the question. The Rambam clearly wanted his book to replace all of Torah Sheba'al Peh. But there's two reasons why, there's two things he could have meant by that. What might the Rambam have meant by that? What did he mean by that? When he says the Mishnah Torah replaces Torah Sheba'al Peh, what exactly did he mean? There's, what does he mean? Very good. Meaning, there's two things he could have meant. One is, he meant practically, for the average Jew on the street, this is a good summary of the halacha. It's not binding.
But then it's not binding.
Well, no. 1 second. Ellie. Let's outline the possibilities of what he meant.
Okay?
One possibility is that the Rambam just meant, look, for the average person in the street, for all intents and purposes, if he wants to know what's happening in the Gemara, he can look at the Rambam. He doesn't mean it's binding. He doesn't mean he is the new Rebbe, literally. He just means that for practical purposes, the average person on the street will need nothing except for the Mishnah Torah. But Poskim, obviously, they could argue on him and look at the Mishnah Torah and, look at the Gemara and argue, right? That's one possibility. What's the second possibility, Ellie?
That
he's meant to be literally replacing the Gemara. Now, what would justify possibility one? What would justify possibility two? Ron.
It would be really, I don't know, it might be just a bad issue if Ron, as I thought, he's able to literally, he's able to, that his work is the end all be all for all of us. For all time. So if we think that a more limited scope of like, oh, you're being a lot of the lay person, and...
Well, why would you say that? Right? Give me a reason. Why? Before we look at what the Rama actually meant, which one he meant by it, right? Why would you say one, why would you say the other? Fine, Ellie, why would you say it?
So I think two is just all on you, because I'm seeing that the Rama never really writes for the average individual.
No, he does. Mr. Dart is totally for the average.
Okay, fine, but regardless, he said that someone never did one like this book,
maybe long. Okay, good. So there's two questions here. What did the Rama mean? And the second is, why would he mean that? So Ellie says, well, he says this replaces all of Torah, so take him at his word. That's what he meant, right? Good. Okay, but conceptually justify it. What's the problem conceptually with saying that, Ellie?
In that you're omitting a lot of, like, discussions.
Okay, so one problem is what everyone had with the Rambam, which is, I mean, what about what everyone else said? Okay, good. But give me a bigger reason, which is? How? By what authority can the Rambam say that he gets to be the new Rebbe? Right? Meaning, where did he pull that authority? Oh, very good. So, obviously, what are you going to have to do? You're going to have to figure out, wait a second, why does the Rambam think that the Bavli was binding and the Mishnah was binding, and could he possibly think that he could replace that? So, okay. So let's see what happens. So the Ravid, not surprisingly, on this comment in Rambam, what does he do? Loses it. He loses it, okay? He is livid. And he says, he flieg mimenu gadol. He exaggerated what he can do. He has, right? Ki yada v'ilu echad makom rayado ladil azra dayan leival yale rabot pamim ki gdu ladil et bazo lo ayom rikashem ani ve'im ato barim meni gadol ay He basically says, what are you doing? He says, why didn't you quote your sources? Meaning, he said, why should I rely on you? Where are all the other positions? Who are you? Right? Meaning, why should I listen to you? What are you, out of your mind? Right? Right? The Rebbe goes nuts. He says, who are you to not quote people, not quote your sources, and basically say that I should listen to you? Are you crazy? Right? Okay. Now, let's see what the Rambam actually thought he was doing. So the truth is that in the Rambam, there seems to be a contradiction if you look through his letters. So if you look in, for example, in 3, in the Igeret HaRambam and Ma'amar Kera Meitim, to Shmuel ibn Tabon, he says, Amar Shmuel ben Yehudi ibn Tabon, Amar HaChacham HaGadol, Rav Rimen Umosh Bar Mamon, Ein Rachok Shech, Havein Adam Leveir, and Yanaktam and Akdamot, Lashon Mevuar, Pashut, Yishtadal, Bolus, Chodos, Vegol, Ezer, Beir, Shem. Vivino Chol, Nevin, Lashon, Ahu, Akdam, Asher, Kivin, Lava, Rav, Ine, Ere, Kayot, Sebeze, Dibrei Hashem, Yitvarach, Shu, Echad, Vein, Shini, Lo, Lashon, Rashinu, Dehur, Sador, Hashemino, Erlo, Zara, Apina, He goes through basically, look, there's always unclarity in God, people don't always understand what he wants, da 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 da, right? So he says, just skip down to after the ellipsis. He says, says, Umashi, here, skip down to like 5-6 lines from the end. Umashi is chayev shiminu kol rabban betar shabal peh. That which everyone has to believe. Ubiyarno peret chelek shorashim is labat chala. That which I put in peret chelek, right? The basic beliefs you have to believe. Ugmul, ratzalom umashi, nitzalai bed yichud. Ubezrat Hashem im sharpino nazarav achena zinu gam gen bechivurenu agadol. He said, I outline the basic things people have to believe in Chilek, in his Hagdama Chilek. Just like it did in Mishnah Torah. Hamuchune Mishnah Torah, Asher lo yakiru malato ela modim ala emet. The Anshei Adad v'chokhmah, and only the people who understand truth will understand what I'm doing. She'el lahem seichel tov v'akara v'divrei achibur v'idiya v'pizur advarim ma'em asher kibadstim v'eich pizartim. Right? And they will see great wisdom in how I organize things. Gam ken kol aninim ikarim hatoriim atamudim v'geninu bazeh sheyijiu eila nikrim tamid chachamim o chachamim gaonim kamo shetikra bo im seifim al shorashim tamidim v'teret or adam stura al pihem. I organize it for the tamid chacham, so everything will be organized. V'dalmidam b'simsula oleh v'kol nivne al ikarim toriim v'lo yaskilu yidiyat Hashem acharei Right, basically, I did this so that they'll have time to focus on philosophy. What does it sound like here? What does the Rambam think his sefer is? It's a good organization, right? Right? He's very clear about this in number 4. In his letter to the Chachmei Lunel, he writes, he's writing right to the Chachmei Lunel, and he says, he's writing about the Mishnah Torah, look at the end of the first column. He says, "V'anashim dolim kachem him yodu mashasiti." Great people will know what did I do. What did I do? Sheikiravti dvarim mefuzarim umufuradim ben agvod arim. I organized everything that was scattered. V'karati otam echad meir u'shnayim u'mishpacha u'shkiyod miyavin. Right. I organized everything. But look, there are mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes. And because everybody makes mistakes, you should research what I wrote in the Talmud and figure out whether I was right. Don't read the Mishnah Torah and say, how could I challenge the Rambam? Don't say that. I give you permission to challenge me. The Yomar Melch Yabo, but Tovam Tolasi to me. By challenging me, you've done great good to me. Anyone who will tell me my mistakes, great. Actually, so that I don't make a mistake and I don't leave mistakes. I just wrote this book to make things clear for students. So, in no uncertain terms, in the Igeret Chachamim Lunil, what does Rambam think he say? Think he did? What? Yeah, he meant a textbook, and therefore, for the average person on the street, Mishnah Torah is good enough. But for Talmidei Chachamim, what should they do? They should go to the Gemara and figure out what the Rambam is right. He made it helpful, but it's not the end, be-all and end-all. Similarly, in the next letter to Rabbi Yosef Bar Yehuda, he says, go to the second paragraph. He says, "Da, can you lo chivart yizeh hevor leitgadel bo Yisrael? I didn't write this to become well known. V'lo kidei lo v'lo shem, so I'd be famous. But that's not my point. What was my point? Akeh alai tachlit, tevatel tachlit asher v'avura, etc. V'amnam chivarti v'ashem hu yodeh l'ashmi t'chila. I wrote it for myself. L'hakeh alai t'chizah v'chipuz, to organize things for myself. It's my own notes. Right? It's my own notes. Especially, when I get old, and I'm not as smart, I want everything organized, right? When my memory starts to go, I'll know that when I was at my prime, I organized the Torah for myself. And I put everything organized. Next paragraph, etc. Right, he goes through how it's meant to organize things, etc. Right? So in some of the letters that the Rambam writes, what does he sound like his goal is? He organized, but it's not meant to be the new Talmud.
Yeah.
Okay?
Was the Rambam saying that someone who realizes he's getting old in this right now, what he should stop
possibly on the highest level?
Or like, what level?
I assume so, yeah, I assume he would. I assume so. However, elsewhere in the Rambam, he says things that sound a little bit different. So let me give you a good example. Here, I just get one good example. Which is the best formulation here? Just look at the top of the third page, right? He says, "Ukvar etibo, I testify." Shalit Rashal tiviv chivur kulo viasteu something. V'alnei b'chol makom lafis tol. So, right, read the whole Mishnah Torah. Lefish atachlida mechuvenet b'ma shechiber b'tamud v'zulato. Right, basically, the purpose of the Gemara and why it was written is already lost. People are wasting their time by learning what the Gemara says. When they learn the Gemara, you end up thinking that the point of life is to argue. Lo zulad zeh. Zulo aitakan arishona. V'matam atan v'ikuach omnam naflu b'mikre. The discussion, the debates in the Gemara is accidental.
Whoa.
Right? Kasher ma'amar shakol pershu b'virush. U'pershu achar b'chilu. Fo atzor kol achad mehem larot open ra'edo l'achri u'pershu. V'akavana arishona omnam aita yidam v'chit tarich la'asor l'izare m'menu. The only point of the Gemara is to figure out what to do. U'lefichach nechlatu anachnu ela mechuvan arishon. Therefore, we wrote the Gemara for the following verse, Lachel Zechriyira To, Lachar Kein Lodia, Kar Avad V'Tokol Divrei Amasan V'Matan V'Nachnu Ma V'Shizolotol Mishiv Char Shein Nuzem Luna. We have basically given you what you need. That's it. Learning the back and forth of the Gemara is a waste of time.
This is confirmed.
Yes. Right, and in the next letter he says, if you learn the back and forth, you will just be wasting your time. You should You should only learn the Rambam. And if you seem there's a machloket, teidushim maybe levad, know that I already dealt with all the machloket. V'im tichlez manchav beirushim. Don't waste your time in commentaries, right? Because they have mi'ura to'elet. They're just a waste of time. They have minimal purpose, right? What? Yes, the Rambam is saying this. Right? So the Rambam sometimes sounds like he's saying, sometimes the Rambam sounds like his goal was organization to make it easier to learn. And sometimes what does he sound like he's doing? Replacing the Talmud. Now, but let's conceptually, you tell me, justify each approach.
It's really difficult to get around the argument with the really seems to be
No, don't justify within the Rambam's book. Justify based on what we've been seeing. If it's about acceptance, right? If the reason we accepted the Babli is about acceptance, then in theory, the Rambam could say, look, if I get everyone to accept me, then what? Then I'm the new Babli. If it's just about acceptance, if it's about some like metaphysical thing like the Chazon Ish, which is until the time of the Gemara they had access to truth, and then you closed the era of Torah, so then can the Rambam possibly be the new Gemara?
No,
because there's something magical, right? What if you have a position that says no? Some hybrid position like Rav Elchanan, which is we accepted it because we recognize that they were the smartest people ever. So then what does the Rambam have to believe? Then if you accept the notion that he's smarter than everybody, right, exactly. So Halbertal has the following theory. Right, Halbertal, his solution is more or less the following, which is the Rambam had two goals. At the moment, he thought all he had done it organized it, but what his aspirational goal was that, yes, was that everyone would recognize that what he did was so good, right? Meaning he argued that the Rambam started by writing something that was so organized, but his aspirational goal was that if everyone recognized that he's wiser and therefore accept it, that those same factors that went into the Babli becoming binding would lead to the Mishneh Torah becoming binding. Right? That's basically his theory. Lawrence Kaplan, in his review of Havotal's book, right, he notes the following. He says, look three lines in. Halbertal goes on to say, beneath this transparency, however, lies an intense ambiguity bearing on the nature of Mishneh Torah itself and the concept of authority that underlies it. Thus, Halbertal asserts there are moderate and radical ways of viewing Maimonides' own understanding of Mishneh Torah's authority. According to the moderate understanding, the Mishneh Torah is a broad, comprehensive representation of the halakha. According to the radical reading, it is not just a representation of the law, but the law itself. Okay? But then, as he notes, Halbertal proceeds to elaborate upon the differences resulting from these two understandings and shows that some statements of Maimonides support the moderate account and others the radical. But are these two accounts as mutually exclusive as Halbertal suggests? In the radical reading, Halbertal notes, the question arises as to the source of the Mishneh Torah's authority. He points to the introduction of Mishneh Torah where Maimonides maintains the authority of the Babylonian Talmud derives from its having been accepted of all of Israel. This view, Halbertal suggests, lays the groundwork for the possibility of Mishneh Torah being transformed into binding halachic work in the event it too is accepted by all of Israel. But this begs the question as to why it would have been accepted. Surely because in the view of all Israel, it constitutes a broad, comprehensive representation of the halacha. And this, indeed, this may not be so far from Maimonides' understanding as to how the Talmud becomes authoritative. For his presentation of the history of halacha in his introduction to the commentary of the Mishnah, Maimonides maintains a point not noted by Halbertal, that the Talmud to begin with was accepted by all of Israel because of its great wisdom. Therefore what? Right? So what Halbertal argues is that The Rambam fundamentally believes in the acceptance view, and therefore the Rambam, his ultimate goal was to get accepted. His intermediate goal was to organize the Gemara well enough that everyone want to read his book. His end goal is, right. Kaplan responds and says, but wait a second. Maybe the Rambam didn't just have an acceptance view. He had a hybrid view, which I would argue is something like Rav Elchanan, which is, we accepted it because we recognized that we were so smart, right? They were so smart, and therefore the Rambam was trying to get accepted by proving to everyone that he was smart. Now, both of those views diverge from a Chazon Ish view, which is there's something magical and fundamental, right? What I think is important about this analysis to recognize, as Ellie correctly pointed out, the question of whether you think, of why you think the Bavli magically becomes accepted, if you think it's accepted simply because it's accepted, or it's accepted because, in general, we're smarter, right? We recognize they're smarter, then in principle, the door isn't closed for creating a new Rambam, right? I'm sorry, a new Gemara. And that's what Halbertal is arguing, and Kaplan in his own way, that the Rambam is essentially either believe that the Gemara itself was accepted because it was accepted, or accepted because they recognize that the Chachmei Talmud were smarter, but both of those views fundamentally lay the groundwork for the Rambam either thinking that he did, or hoping that he one day would be the new Talmud. Those reads are impossible to accept if you take a Chazon Ish view, which is there's something fundamental about Kufar HaTalmud, right? That makes it more binding, whatever you think that is. And therefore, the question of what made the Mishnah binding, what makes the Gemara binding, are important when you're trying to figure out what is going to be the authority of later codes. Right? And therefore, I think this question of what did the Rambam intend and how could he have meant that is really important when you're weighing, well, what exactly were the mechanisms in place for the Bavli, and does that leave room open for something else coming along to be the next Gemara? Now, I'm not going to get into this too much, but I'll just finish with this. That Eli asked, well, what about Shulchan Aruch? Now, as far as I know, no one has quite said the same thing about Shulchan Aruch that radically. But Shulchan Aruch himself, when he's explaining why he wrote the Shulchan Aruch, what does he say in the Beit Yosef, rather? Why was he organizing? Because Rabbu Asaro, there were so many trials and tribulations, and therefore it's hard, and therefore we had to organize everything, and therefore I'm collecting everything, and you should follow the vote of the great three poskim. I mean, you already see echoes. He's not as radical as the Rambam, right? He doesn't think you have to, because even Shulchan Aruch admits that if you have a long-standing minhag, you don't have to follow him. But the fact that he invokes the same type of arguments, which are, there have been trials and tribulations, it's hard to track down the sources, never I'm organizing it, and unless you have a contrary minhag, you should follow me, right? What is he essentially doing? Yeah, right? And some of the language that comes up in later generations, which is, why do you follow Shulchan Aruch? So some people say, because we accepted it, right? We accepted Kimu v'Kiblu to follow Shulchan Aruch or Ramah. Others say, why do we accept Shulchan Aruch? Because they were the last Sfarim that were written by Ruach HaKodesh, right? What exactly do you see there? The exact same dynamic playing out, which is some people say Shulchan Aruch gets its authority from acceptance. You have other people saying it gets its authority from truth or from metaphysical reality, right? The exact same mechanisms you see playing out in the Bavli, in the Rambam, in Shulchan Aruch. And therefore, I do think it's important to recognize that, yes, the exact same principles play out, maybe not to the same extent, but indeed play a role in subsequent acceptance or the lack thereof of codes and the like, okay? So I can give you sources. I'm not going to spend another day in shiur on it, but I can give you sources where you see this exact same machloket play out in the dynamic over Shulchan Aruch. But now you understand that so much of this really comes back to, did we, and if so, why did we accept the mission of the Gemara, etc.? Because once you set those mechanisms in place, you understand why the same types of debates will emerge over the Rambam, will emerge over Shulchan Aruch, will emerge over the Mishnah Brura, right? Okay. With that, we will leave this. So yeah, tomorrow we're going to start on the Yerusha stuff. I hope you guys had fun. I think this is an interesting topic, and since it emerged from our sugya, it was worth doing. Fine.